Welcome to the Business Growth Podcast with me, Kevin Miller. On this podcast, you're going to hear some awesome interviews from business leaders, experts, and entrepreneurs as they share their story, their journey, and some expert tips and insight of the things they've learned along the way. So sit back, enjoy, learn, and grow. And thanks for joining me. I've got Dr. Rick Charlesworth with me in the studio. Good morning, Rick.
Morning, Kevin.
Thanks very much for coming in. It's you've got a huge list of credentials there, and I'm extremely grateful for you coming in to share your experience and your knowledge of working with elite athletes and success and getting success and winning, essentially, which is something that everybody's trying to do, regardless if it's business, personal, or in sport. And before we go into sort of the chat, Rick, I just sort of like to list through some of the things that you've done. I mean, you've been the former captain of the Australian hockey team, played hockey for a record 17 years for Australia, first-class cricket for nearly a decade, the national coach of the Australian women's hockey team from 1993 to 2000, men's hockey coach from 2009 to 2014, coach of the year 8 times, you've won Commonwealth gold medals, been to World Cups, Olympics. And you've written books on coaching and leadership. You've done a lot of things, Rick.
Yeah, I've been busy.
You've been busy, so that's why I'm very grateful for you coming in. And in between that, you've also been an elected member of Parliament as well.
Yeah, I had a decade in the federal parliament.
Yeah,
I think there's a chapter in one of my books, "Interesting Job, Terrible Lifestyle," which I think just about sums it up.
So the reason I asked you, and obviously fantastic credentials, and successful person, and a breadth of knowledge. I believe there's a lot of parallels between competitive sport and business. You know, there's a lot of things that are transferable skills in terms of teamwork, leadership, success. But where I want to start with you is really the drive. You know, we just said all those things that you've done and you've been involved in. Where does your drive come from to want to do these things and to challenge yourself?
Yeah, I suppose I grew up. Was born in Perth. I grew up in Perth. It's a fantastic place. I feel very privileged to have been here. And there were lots of opportunities. I was interested in things.
Yep.
I played a lot of sport as a kid, and so that carried on. And when I was at university, then I was able to continue to play sport. If you're into that, you want to do it well, mm-hmm. and that was my thing. Let's see how good we can be. And of course, we were very lucky. We had a terrific hockey program in this country. Also, we had a good cricket program. You know, when I played for WA in the 70s, we won the Sheffield Shield 5 times, I think, in that decade. So
yeah,
we had good teams, and so that was part of the caper. And the hockey program was exciting, because this was a sport that took you all over the world. You got to play in all sorts of different countries. You saw the world. I'll make the comparison. I played AFL too until I was about 15, but I just hate getting beaten up. You know, you'd get the ball and you'd run out of packets. Some guy just flatten you, and I thought, why am I doing this?
So do something a bit more finesse.
Well, it was about, hockey was a game about skill and speed and guile. And that's what you were rewarded for, in a lot of the other sports, that at some stage or other, you've got to beat someone up, and I didn't like that much.
Yeah.
I don't think I was afraid, just, you got blindsided, and, we're seeing the issue with CTE. It'll be increasingly an issue in, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, people getting damaged with concussions.
Yes.
That'll continue to be worse, and I'm glad I didn't play a sport that entailed that.
And so, obviously, in the early days, when you're a younger person and you're involved in sport, sport breeds competitiveness anyway. Generally, if you're not a competitive person, when you're in that sporting environment, you do want to win. Essentially, that's ultimately what more people do it for that than probably the enjoyment. And certainly at an elite level as well. But in the beginning, when you were sort of learning the sports that you were doing, the cricket and the hockey. Did you sort of see yourself? Did you know you were good at it, or
Yeah, I was pretty good, but I I loved doing it. I spent hours and hours in the backyard practicing and playing against my older brothers and competing. And I had like success. I got selected in teams and opportunities came along. And then it was, you know, we can be better at this. How can we get better? And so there was a constant search for improvement and to become outstanding. Yeah. I was very lucky. I played in a local hockey club in which there were Olympians,
and
indeed the captain of our first Olympic team in 56 came from our club, and you know I played my first game in the seniors when he got injured, you know, so I sort of took his place, and so there was that that example was there, it was just for us to see, and Western Australia did well in hockey, and so a lot of the players who were playing in the local club competition were in Olympians, and they competed internationally, and so that experience came back to our club, and the sport grew on that, and so that was a terrific opportunity, and you got to watch the game being played overseas.
Yep.
That brought all sorts of other opportunities, and now you know players from our competitions can get a game in India, they can get a game in Europe, they can play in the United States. There's a whole range of ways in which you can expand your horizons through the game. So that was the opportunity, but the search to get better, I think, was important to me.
Yep.
And that's one of the things that probably in the end I accidentally fell into coaching. It was never an ambition.
Right, okay. Yeah.
But that's what happened.
And being around in that environment when you were playing then in the hockey scenario, I guess, being around Olympians and I guess other managers, coaches at that point, where, you know, the Olympians, for instance, what were you noticing that they were doing in terms of sort of preaching good habits to you? Were you learning good habits from them?
Yeah. Yeah, you saw how they went about it, you know, how they trained, how they prepared, you know. And indeed, as I said, the fellow who was the captain of the first Olympic team in 56 in Melbourne was in our club. And he used to come to training and he was a pharmacist by training, so he had a business. He would get there at 4:30 and he would train himself for the first hour, you know, and go through a routine and like as an example to a young player. He was self-driven.
Yeah.
And indeed, that's what you want. You want athletes who have, are internally motivated, who have their own drive. And I think those examples, they stuck and you learn from them.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, I mean, there are some things that sport does better than business, you know.
Yeah.
And so some of those messages are important. And the thing that principally sport does better than business is sport understands training.
Yes.
Athletes train more than they play, you know. And
makes sense.
there's a game on the weekend or there's 20 or 30 games in the season, so you spend a lot of time preparing for those. Mm-hmm. Those showcase games, if you like. It's interesting when I speak to people in business, they say, oh yeah, but somebody's got to answer the phones and speak to customers and do all the things that are the nuts and bolts of your business.
Yes.
And my response to them is, yes, but every situation that occurs every day at work is a training opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a good manager, then you need to be coaching those guys every day, or those girls, or whoever's working in your organisation.
Mm-hmm.
Your job is as a trainer, as a coach, to take advantage of those situations. Yeah, this occurred and we didn't quite get it right, but how are we going to improve it? And, oh, yeah, this was my interaction today. How am I going to make it better the next day? Well, this didn't work. Let's learn from it. And I think that what you do as a coach is you put players in the situation where they where they're basically mimicking the match. You create a little training drill which mimics something that might happen in a game, and you put them through it, and you overload one team, or you make it more difficult for the other team, or you
the scenarios of it.
You put those scenarios in front of them, and they train them and practice them, and hopefully you can make it harder than the match. And so when they get into the match, they're comfortable handling what comes along.
Yeah, and that's true. Like in terms of business, you don't always train scenarios, do you? You train the theory potentially. You train the what you need to know to take care of the task, but you don't actually train the eventualities of this situation might occur or that situation might occur. And I guess that's one huge difference between what you've mentioned.
It's a nuts and bolts thing. I mean, my formal training was in medicine, you know, and so I started in the hospital, when you start as an intern in the hospital in your first year, there's a lot of practical things you're not on top of.
Yes.
You know, you're training on the job. Now, almost every job you get, that's the case, you know. You might go through your formal preparation, but then when you get there, you actually have to handle the nuts and bolts of it day after day. That's the reality. And, you know, we're here at a university. Mm-hmm. The university prepares people for working lives, but, you know, it's the on-the-job stuff that's really important. That's why apprenticeships and on-the-job training is such an important part of preparing yourself for what you're going to do.
And do you think being a good coach, leader or manager is actually identifying or understanding what all those different scenarios are, or having the knowledge to know what they can be or may be, because then you can prepare your team for those situations?
Yeah, well, I think you need some technical knowledge, you know, and the detail and that technical knowledge is an important part of a coach's preparation. You have to, if you like, understand the theory and what are the tactics and how would you handle the situation. You also need to train technique, you know, you've got to learn the proper way to do things, you know, or you learn a way to accommodate someone's technique which might not be classical, you know. Yes. I mean, John McEnroe didn't have the perfect serve, but who's going to fiddle with it, you know, because it was working.
It's unique,
you know.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, in every case, you have to be able to identify what works and what doesn't work, and you have to be practical about it. So you got to do all of that. But, you know, the big job in coaching is managing all the personalities and the individuals.
Yes.
And then trying to get people to cooperate. Mm-hmm. That's really hard, you know.
And did you learn? So you said you came into the coaching by accident, I guess, or you weren't, it wasn't your intention to always be a coach?
No. Well, you know, my training was in medicine. I worked in the hospital for a number of years. I decided general practice wasn't really where I wanted to end up, so I was going to do some more training. Mm-hmm. Or another opportunity came along, and the political chance came along, and I was interested in politics. So then I was fortunate to get elected. I was part of the Hawke and Keating governments, you know, from 83 to 93.
Yep.
And then, you know, I made a lifestyle choice. My kids were growing up and I wasn't seeing them, and my marriage had failed, and so I was, what am I going to do? I made a lifestyle choice. I had the safest seat in Western Australia, so I could have still been the member for Perth if I'd wanted to stay that long. But so I decided I wasn't going to continue in the parliament, and I was going to go back and practice medicine.
Yep.
And do some more study. And I got a phone call from a girl who played in our club, who'd just come back from the Barcelona Olympics. The team hadn't done so well, and she said, "Why don't you think about coaching our team?" She knew that I'd been a coach in the club,
mm-hmm.
and indeed, since I was 17, I'd been involved. The expectation in the hockey club was that you were involved in coaching the juniors, and eventually I coached the senior team, and I coached the state under 21 team, so I had a fair bit of experience in coaching. And so I applied for the job, and I was a controversial appointment, you know, for the women's job way back in 1993. Mm-hmm. And so I started going to work in a t-shirt and a pair of shorts rather than a suit and a tie.
That different, eh?
which was a big improvement. But I was very lucky because there were a group of athletes who were very ambitious, hardworking, talented, and who wanted to be the best in the world. Mm-hmm. And that was a terrific environment in which to work.
Were you nervous at that point? Like, were you, like, you know?
You're always jumping in off the deep end. Oh, but I knew the hockey capable. I played 17 years in the men's team. I knew hockey backwards.
Yes.
And I think I had the technical knowledge. I'd studied medicine, so I understood the physiology, the psychology, a lot of that stuff, perhaps better than many. And I'd been in the parliament speaking on my feet for a decade.
So you had all the attributes anyway.
In some ways, you know, I'd done the work, and I might have come from another direction, but I certainly had the attributes, I think, that you needed. And I had a lot of ideas about how we could change the game and do it better, and, mm-hmm. and we were able to, you know, I got a good group of people together,
and
we worked hard at building a good team, and I didn't know how good they were. After a while, I thought, oh, these girls are very talented. We can win things here. And, you know, the bit that I can take some credit for is that over a decade we were sustainably good.
Yes,
you know,
consistent.
We were good enough to win major tournaments, the World Cups, the Olympics, the Commonwealth Games, the champions trophies, but we won them for a decade. That was the special thing about that group of players. And you know, when you're a coach, your job is to try and help people realize their potential. It's not a selfish thing at all. It's actually quite a giving thing, and I found it a very satisfying job to be in. And
in terms of the rewards of seeing the results of the work that you're putting in, and the cohesion in the team, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and being able to do that was an experiment in how we can do that, and let's do this better.
Yep.
And we did a range of things which were quite controversial at the time. You know, we changed the leadership structure. We didn't have a captain at the end by the time we got to the Sydney Olympics, you know.
Oh, right, okay.
We shared the leadership.
Did you come up to some, did you have some resistance to that initially?
Sure, yeah. There was an article in the Australian newspaper, Leading the Leaderless Team, and it described me as being Lenin-like, you know, as a communist. And I rang the journalist.
And your shorts and T-shirts.
But I rang up the journalist and I said, well, our team's not leaderless, our team's leaderful. And I want everybody to act and behave like a leader in our group. Because in the end, you need a critical mass of leaders if your team's going to be successful.
Yeah.
You know?
And how do you create leaders then? You know, so that's, you know...
You give them opportunity. Everybody's got it in them. I don't think it's necessarily special. Everyone has the capacity, and you ask them and you expect them to step up, and you give them opportunities to do so. Everybody in your group has something to offer. Some people are set a tone at training. They're really hard workers at training, so they set an example for the group. That's leadership.
Yes.
Some people maybe do inspirational things on the pitch. You've got special skills that provides leadership. Others off the field are very socially gregarious, so they include those on the periphery and they help bind the group together. That's leadership. Mm-hmm. Some people will put their hands up and say, I made a mistake, I got it wrong. That's very good example of leadership. Yeah. You know, that's what you need in the group. Sometimes when everybody wants to do A, there's others who'll say, oh, what about B? Mm-hmm. You know, that's leadership too, because we have to, you need diversity.
Yes.
And so you have to give an opportunity for expression for those athletes. And like, I'm much maligned, I think, in some ways, because the people said, oh, he's a hard, tough bugger. You know, well, I actually co-designed my programs with the athletes. I saw myself as a servant of the athletes.
Yeah, so you had their participation and their feedback in the process. Yeah.
Absolutely. And the great innovators in sport aren't the coaches, they're the athletes. And so you better be listening. There better be a dialogue going on, because they're having to solve practical problems every minute. Mm-hmm. Just like in your business.
Yeah.
The people on the shop floor very often know the answer rather than the people in the front office. Mm-hmm. And you better be having that dialogue. Otherwise, you're not maximising the capacity of all the people in the program. And, you know, when you get to the national team like we had, then all of those players are captain or, you know, authority figures in their local teams and whatever. Yep. So they have that capacity. It's just a case of really giving them the opportunity to express it. Now, that's a difficult cocktail to mix if you want to put all that together.
Yeah, it would be, yeah.
So that's challenging. And in my opinion, the big area for improvement in sport is not technical, tactical, sports science, all of that stuff necessarily now, although it's maybe what people would call soft science, but it's in human behaviour.
Okay.
And understanding how people think and why they do what they do, and getting them to, if you like, cooperate together. Mm-hmm. And if you can do that, then you can build a team that becomes bulletproof. Because everybody's covering everyone else. They're understanding what's going on. They're working for one another. Sometimes they're sublimating their personal ambitions for the group. And you really get a cohesive environment. But it's hard and difficult, and it's nebulous, you know. It requires constant work, like your garden. You know, you've got to keep watering it.
Is the reason that you decided to have that leadership model then, or that team leadership model, is the reason that you identified that or decided to do that because you've seen that there was a better cohesive unit or a better chance of success by doing that and using the personnel that you have? Or what was the reason for it? Like, what was the... Because it's going against the grain. You know, when you go against the grain, you're disruptive and you're doing something different to everybody else. So there's always you must have had a real passion for something.
My experience of sport was it's pretty conservative. And I'd been the captain for the team, and I think sometimes I took the team in a direction that might have suited me, but wasn't necessarily the best, you know. So you've got to understand and be introspective about that.
Yes.
But I think that's human nature, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to call the shots, or lots of people do, sometimes not with the best motivation. But if you have, if you like, as your abiding aim, is this good for the team, as the central principle, then you question everything that happens with that in mind, then you can lead yourself and the group in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, yeah, we knew what we wanted to achieve. We wanted to become the world's best team and then sustainably stay there. And then
not just get it, but keep it, do it, keep doing it.
And then
to win
at the highest level. I thought we were good enough to win things, but after a few years I thought, well, we can continue to do this if we work harder than the other teams and we're more innovative and we create differences, and when the rules change we adjust quicker. And so, you know, interchange came in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the best decisions I made is I said, we're going to embrace the interchange. We're going to play with 16 players, not with 11 anymore.
Yeah,
the other teams were very reluctant to do that, and it took almost a decade in the men's game for people to actually, because the senior players want to be on the field all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but
yeah,
we were monitoring them and we could see that they were actually tired and resting
yeah.
on the field. Come and sit next to me and someone else can be playing and yeah. we can increase the tempo of our game.
Maximise the performance of your team, yeah.
But the offshoot with that was, after we'd been doing that for a couple of years, instead of having like 15 players who had played 60 matches and, you know, 15 who'd played 5, we had 30 players who'd all played 50 matches or
yeah.
40 matches,
yeah.
you know, and they all believed they could do it. So that created internal competition in the team.
Yeah.
And so they all pushed one another. Mm. And that internal competition was good for pushing standards and improving the quality, you know. And so by embracing the interchange, we actually increased the tempo and the way in which we were playing and the quality with which we could play, but we also gave credibility to all of those athletes who maybe had been sitting on the periphery. And I mean, this is a story that occurred in 1994. I was the new coach of the team. I went to the national championships. You're always looking for new talent, and I saw a young girl from Victoria who I thought was interesting. And I said to the selectors,
yeah.
what about her? And they said, oh, she's not good enough. She used to be in the team before you were the coach. We've tried her out. No, not good enough. And I watched a couple more days and I went and sat with that girl. And I said to her, well, tell us your story. And she said, oh, I was in the program for 2 years. I came to Perth at the Institute of Sport. You know, I've been overseas with the national team 5 times. I've played 11 minutes.
Yeah.
So she was sat on the bench.
Yeah, so she never had the opportunity to do anything.
And you know, when you sit someone on the bench, what's the message? Mm. We don't think you're good enough.
Good enough,
you
yeah.
know? Mm-hmm. So in the end, we included her in our team, and she got injured a year or two later, so she only had a short career. But her last game for Australia was the Olympic final. She's a gold medalist, that
wow.
girl.
Yeah,
you
well,
know?
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's excellent. That's awesome.
So, yeah, and I think that you have to provide opportunity. The most important thing, I think, as a coach is you give opportunity for people.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, then they aren't left wondering, what if,
yeah.
you know? And the thing about sport is it generally is a meritocracy. Usually if you perform, you get recognised and, you know, recognised
mm-hmm.
the good thing about it. You know, one of my frustrations with politics is that sometimes, you know, the factions were more important than some of the other considerations. And while in many, many ways the Hawke and Keating government was a very good government because it was quite disciplined and cohesive, after a while, then, you know, there wasn't a change.
Mm-hmm.
Your football team changes every year. You know, there are new
yeah.
players coming in and others moving out. And in some ways,
that then prevents the sustainability, then, doesn't it? The consistency, if you're changing the team and changing the personnel all the time, you're not going to have the consistency of that. Unless, you know, you'll have the ideals and you'll have the values that you're creating, but you'll not have the people that have bought into them for the period of time.
Well, but like, you know, we had from Atlanta Olympics to the Sydney Olympics, there were 8 players who were the same and 8 who changed.
Right, okay.
The team still, you know, many of those values and many of those who they maybe missed out in Atlanta, they were then playing.
Mm-hmm.
So they were involved in the environment. They understood the environment.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, your football team changes all the time. It can still be good.
Yes.
You've got, but, well, we tried to find Bob Dylan's record, didn't we? The times they were changing. I was
a
Dylan devotee earlier, you know, and he says things like, you know, the order is rapidly fading. The first one now will later be last for the times they are changing. You know,
yes.
that's the
yeah.
reality of
yeah.
our life is that there is and while people resist change, you have to actually embrace it.
Accept that, yeah.
And sport is, as I said, very conservative. I don't think, you know, like captaincy, in my opinion, is an anachronism from another era, from another century.
That's an older way of looking at things.
Yeah, when sport was invented, you know, it's a pretty recent thing. And it might not be around in another 100 years, I can tell you. That's the way it's going. Mm-hmm. But when it was invented, life was very paternalistic and hierarchical. And so, yeah, we have a captain, someone in charge, but it doesn't work like that. No. You need everybody to be thinking
in the same direction,
strategically out in the field, you know?
What I'd like to sort of talk about now moving forward is, you know, once you have a successful team and you have a, you create the sustainability, you know, and when you win things, I guess, when you actually do win tournaments and win championships, how do you keep, you know, is it hard to keep people motivated because they might be, you know, they achieve certain pinnacles or they achieve certain things? Is it hard to keep people going to do the next one, I suppose?
Yeah, well, I think sometimes, you know, getting to be number one is difficult, but sustainably staying there is even harder. And if the athletes, for every athlete, it really ought to be about how I can be better and becoming the best I can be. And if that's the goal, then I think there's continuous improvement. You can continue to make that. And if the goal of the team is how can we continue to work better cooperatively, then you're introspective about the things you got wrong, you're learning from your errors, and you're constantly trying to build something better and new. There's an upside all the time. But it's very easy to get confident, overconfident, complacent, and we've done it and that's enough, you know, and if that's the case, then maybe you need to go and do something else. And so that's why the team needs to constantly be refreshed, because with new young players, new players, with different people comes more ambition. And sometimes that's the thing that drives the older ones too. When they see that happening, then it remotivates them. One of the important things I think you have to do is you have to give people new tasks, continually challenge them. And so, for instance, we had 8 players who played in Sydney who were playing in Atlanta at the Olympics. Only one of them was playing in the same position. All of the others had been given a different task. And so their skills were still relevant. But we had a player who was a striker, a goal scorer at one Olympics, was a deep defender at the next.
Yeah, okay.
But who knows best what a striker doesn't like than someone who used to be one.
To be, yeah, that's
so,
right.
You know, so you, and traditionally those transitions don't occur, but they can occur if you think like that and you're willing to reinvent yourself. And that's important. That has to be a part of what you're doing as a coach, constantly looking for something that's going to challenge that athlete.
And how do you identify that as a coach then? If you're, you know, how you obviously see things happening within the team, but how do you identify, or how do you have the, I guess, the confidence to change those tasks or to change those roles, to put a striker as a defender or vice versa?
Yeah, well, you come up with the idea and you experiment and you practice and you know that's how you work things out.
Yeah.
I never met an athlete yet. You know, I was 14 years coach of the national team, men and women, who knew how good they could be.
Yeah.
And my job was to keep lifting the bar for them.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what you have to do. You have to create that environment. And, you know, I coached a long time and we had good teams, but I never changed anybody. You know, I created an environment in which they changed themselves.
Yes.
And that's what has to happen. You know, people change themselves. They get motivated. They make the shifts that are necessary, they put in the work, and you know, that's, if you like, is the satisfying thing about being a coach, that you can be a catalyst for that change.
And that goes back to the given that you were talking about as well. It's more of a given thing. It's, you're giving them the opportunity to change. You're giving them the steps to do that. You're pointing them in the right direction, aren't you?
Yeah. I mean, who are the most important people in our society? You know, it's not the guy selling real estate or the company making widgets or whatever. It's the teachers.
Yes.
And yet, you know, we've failed as a society because we don't give respect or reward teachers as we should. And, you know, the Scandinavian countries have done it well. They give teachers status and they pay them accordingly. And so the best people get involved and they are the ones who influence the young people in that society. Now, we haven't paid attention to that. You know, we've made education about choice and competition, which is a business model,
yes.
which doesn't work in education, in my opinion. Education ought only be about quality. Mm-hmm. Now, in coaching, it really has to be about quality. And you know, the thing that you have to hold on to is that I'm not going to compromise on that. We have to set standards that are high, and we have to demand quality from people. Now, that's difficult. If you want to be an elite athlete, it's difficult and challenging and uncomfortable. And so when I hear athletes saying, oh, I don't feel comfortable, then, well, hang on. Go and do something else.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I listened to Matthew Hayden recently being interviewed, very good cricketer for Australia,
yes. yep.
you know,
yeah,
more than 100 test matches, yep. wonderful batsman. He said he never felt comfortable in all the time he played. He always felt like he had to perform
really?
To be assured of his place. And that's the reality, you know, elite performers constantly on edge.
On their toes, yeah.
yeah.
Do you think that can affect certain individuals' performance, though? Athletes, I guess, then in this capacity, that by being on edge and being on their toes, some will thrive on it. Some will really, you know, relish that challenge. But have you come across other people that the opposite happens, where it affects their performance, or they can't handle the pressure of that?
Well, I think that's the environment, and you know, elite sport is a difficult environment and challenging. I mean, how many people are measured publicly on a weekly basis?
Yeah.
Like athletes are. You can read the paper today and you'll see how so-and-so performed last week. You know, Nat Fyfe had quite a good game, but he kicked six points. Jesus, you know. Well, but you know, nobody's – most people aren't being measured publicly, you know, for their performance. Mm. So it's that's the environment in which you – now, if you want the money and the acclaim and all the other things that go with it, then you better understand that's the environment in which you have to operate. Mm-hmm. The Olympics, you know, you get one chance every 4 years, not a game next week and another game next week, another game. So you better be prepared well for that and put everything into it. But when you do make such an investment on such a short, you know, opportunity, then the tension and the pressure and all of the stresses are even greater.
As a coach, if you've seen a player or identified a player that was maybe that was affecting, that situation was affecting, how would you sort of deal with that situation?
Well, I think you try and put people at training, we try and challenge them, we put them under pressure, we give them difficult tasks to do and become able to do so.
Yeah.
But I'm not suggesting that they ever ought to feel really comfortable because, you know, one of my old adages was that the job of the coach is to comfort the troubled and trouble the comfortable.
Yeah, the trouble the comfortable are like.
Yeah. So you do provide support for people who are challenged,
yeah.
and that's an important part of it. But in the end, if they want to be performing, you know, at the elite level, mm-hmm. then understand that it's going to be a fraught environment.
That's part of it.
If you want to just play on the weekend and have fun, that's fine too. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. It's just not the right place to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you don't even bother go to training if you're doing that, you know, or you just turn up and you're with your mates and it's afterwards, you have a good time. But at the elite level, then this is going to be tough.
Mm-hmm. Right, we're running out of time shortly, but what I'd like to ask you before we head off is if someone is a leader or a manager or a coach, what would you say is there in order for them to be a better leader or a better coach or a manager? What would you suggest that they need to what do they need to do, or what should they sort of embrace?
Well, I think for me, leadership's about two things essentially. One is real definition about where you want to go to. What do I want to achieve? What are our goals? Where are we going? So there needs to be definition about that, not, oh, yeah, we'd like to do well or whatever. Well, no, let's put it, write it down
make
on paper.
Clear.
Let's make it clear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, okay, my job was easy in some ways. We're going to win the gold medal at the end of this 4 years, you know.
Yeah.
So that's the long-term goal, is put it away and focus on the process. You know, first thing you have to do is focus on the process. The outcome will look after itself. The other thing is you have to be able to take people with you, persuade them to come. And you do that by your example, by the way in which you go about things. You do it by your ability to make an argument. This is why we need to do A, B, C.
Mm-hmm.
These things will make a difference if we do them. Here's the evidence. And so you definition about where you're going, and then persuading people that this is where we need to go,
yep.
and that is by your example, by your demeanour, by your quality of your argument, by the persuasiveness of your rhetoric, a commitment to where you're going to go.
Rick, it's been an absolute pleasure. That's great advice. We've not even covered any of the experiences of being at the Olympics, which I would love to talk to you about as well, but we are running out of time. So, you know, thank you for your insight. Thank you for the advice that you've given us. And, you know, I'm very grateful for you coming in. Thanks very much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Joining me on this episode of the Business Growth Podcast. If you enjoyed it and you want to come back for more, don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or wherever it is you get your podcasts. You can catch up with me on social media on Facebook at Make My Business Better, Instagram at Business Growth AU, or you can jump on our website www.businessgrowthperth.com.au. See you next time.